The man some call the first famous classical male ballet dancer America ever produced has an engrossing new memoir out, and in I Was a Dancer, Jacques d'Amboise takes us deep inside the dance world. We learn, for instance, that there's a special garter that top ballerinas wear when they marry, passed from couple to couple, the ballet order of the garter. That Russian-born choreographer George Balanchine insisted that students practice even while eating your eggs and brushing your teeth. And that years after Balanchine died, Jacques and dancer Karen von Aroldingen, deep in grief, dance a waltz at his grave. D'Amboise was actually born Jack Ahern, his mom French-Canadian, his dad Irish, a family that saw the occasional homeless shelter until landing in New York's tough Washington Heights neighborhood in the 40s, where boys just didn't do ballet. And one day, Jacques writes, he was confronted by his pals at the candy store.
"Hey, Jacques, what the hell is all this stuff about ballet? You taking dancing lessons?" And I just told the truth. "It's great. It's so hard. And there's this guy, Aglefsky, who jumps up in the air and he stays there for a while and he's got all these muscles and he does this step called a sauté. Here, I'm going to show you." I put my practice bag on the sidewalk, leaped in the air, moving sideways over my bag, and landed on the other side. Then I said, "That's only a few feet. Aglefsky goes much higher. You want to try it?" Then I put down soda bottles, assorted jackets and caps, and I choreographed them sauteing in concert all over the sidewalk.
In his later years, Jacques would again teach kids from tough neighborhoods how to dance. But from the age of 17 until he retired in 1983, Jacques d'Amboise was a principal dancer with the storied New York City Ballet, led by Russian-born choreographer George Balanchine and his mercurial backer, Lincoln Kirstein. D'Amboise gives us insight into both and tells of dancing with the great ballerinas of our day. He joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Delighted, Robin, to be on this program.
Well, a big introduction because a big life. And let's just go back to the beginning. Your mom, Georgette, you called her the boss. She was. And she would take you to these teachers in New York and almost force you on them, ballet, music. Why was it so important to her that you take ballet lessons?
She was, now you have to picture, 4'9" and heavy French accent, French-Canadian, and never finished herself elementary school. By 12 years old, she was working in shoe factories up in Maine. And her sisters and her, they read Victor Hugo and Dumas. And my mother, dreaming of the court of Louis XIV, the dance, the music, she dreamt that her children would have all these things. And she made it happen. And that's why we called it a boss.
Yeah. Well, and she just so fiercely wanted this for you. And it seemed that after you first started it, you wanted it so badly, too. And it, between the church and the lessons that you were having, you wanted to fly. You believed that if you prayed hard enough, God would help you fly, to the point where you went to the roof of your building and jumped off. We don't recommend this for kids. You know, you had a cape on and a costume because you thought you could fly. But was that in part what it was about, that you wanted to soar?
I was dreaming of flying, and it's at the root of what classical ballet is, to be off the ground, to be in a higher place. And the nuns were talking about the novena. If you did this ritual of prayers in the right order, you would then make a request of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of Jesus, and you would get your gift. And, of course, there's the escape clause that I never noticed till later. But the nun would mumble after telling you that, "If it's good for you." And I went up to the roof and jumped. I really fell about 2.5 stories.
Yeah, but still, we recommend it. And then ultimately you do fly. You join the New York City Ballet. You meet a woman who's just a few years older. She will become your wife, Carolyn George. But before that, you travel to Europe. Older men, you know, take you out to homes of ill repute to try to educate you.
Oh, yes.
Suddenly you're 15, 16 years old. You're in this world. That's also this cultured world of these Russians that, you know, with Balanchine. What was that like to suddenly be in this world?
I was loving it, jumping, just trying to do my best. And not fall on my face, and thinking all the time that this was temporary. I would be a priest, or I'd be a doctor, or I'd be a stagehand. And it was quite a while until I was in my early 20s that I realized I wanted to dance. I didn't want to do anything else but dance. And by then, I'd already done a movie. And
well, you mentioned the movie. This is the film Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, one of the great musicals. It has the famous competition barn dance number where the brothers, including you, try to outdance their rivals, leaping over sawhorses, throwing axes. Let's listen to it. Yeah! Becoming a star. I mean, the dance world is also deciding they want you. Then you and the company travel through Russia. This is during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Balanchine's first return to his homeland. Incredible stories. Tell us more about Balanchine, so much a part of your story, a god to so many people. What was he to you?
He was a mentor, a teacher, my choreographer, a father figure, a friend, and a guide for a belief in, I'd say it's good manners. Just as an example, I'm 15. I quit school and I joined the Exit Valley. Before I'm 16, we're on our way to Covent Garden and Royal Opera House to dance. So Balanchine says to me, "You know, we may have tea with Queen. I have to show you how to have tea." Diaghilev showed me.
Oh.
And Diaghilev, of course, was the great impresario that Balanchine had been his ballet master and danced with. So he made me rehearse how to have tea with the queen. You pick up the silver tongs to put one lump of sugar in. Make sure it doesn't plunk or splash. Now pick up the silver spoon and only half a swirl. Don't stir it. Just one little bzzz. And you've just done half a circle.
I'm taking notes in case I ever have tea with the queen.
And this knocked me for a loop. What I never realized is you always leave tea in the cup. You don't drink it to the dregs.
Yeah, don't down it. Well, but what did Balanchine teach you about dance? I mean, obviously we could spend hours on that, but what if you had to put it in one sentence, what would it be?
Exact, precise, and 100%. Don't hold back.
Welcome back to our conversation with former New York City Ballet dancer Jacques d'Amboise, whose new memoir is I Was a Dancer. We first spoke in 2005 when he was in Boston collecting an award for his National Dance Institute, working with local dance students.
One, two, and three.
In 1957, when Jacques d'Amboise was himself first starting out, choreographer George Balanchine revived his first masterpiece, Apollo, just for d'Amboise. The music is Stravinsky. At the end, an enlightened Apollo ascends Mount Olympus with the muses of dance, poetry, and mime. Jacques d'Amboise, Apollo was transformative for you, as it was for Balanchine when he was young. What did he tell you about it?
He described his ballet as a wild, untamed youth gains nobility through art. And in the beginnings, of course, they did it the way you would do it in the 20s. They had Apollo with golden curls and a tunic. But when he revived it for me, he said black and white, simple, American boy. And when the Olshansky, who was the makeup man, couldn't wait to get his hands on my hair and curl it and spray it gold, Balanchine said, "No, leave, grease." Because, you know, around that time, everybody was putting slicked hair.
Right, he wanted you to look like somebody from West Side Story.
Yeah.
But so here you are dancing these parts. Was it flying as you'd hoped, or is it more, "Oh, this hurts"? What is it?
Okay. As a boy, 16, 17, I would run and jump over a car. I found a way of dreaming of flying by taking an art form. I didn't become a pilot. I became a dancer famous for enormous leaps, and I always approached each performance as if it was my first. And then I always approached it as it was my last. So for me, each performance was the performance. And the other thing, oh my God, can you imagine dancing night after night with some of the most beautiful dancers in the world?
I want to ask you about that. You once asked him who he thought was the greatest. He said Allegra Kent. Some might have thought he'd say Suzanne Farrell. But what about for you? Who was your favorite partner?
Well, every time I was making love to these women on the stage, through the music and through the dance and through the choreography. And now I watch these dancers, and I'm an old man. I've got artificial knees, I've got broken toes, I've got torn shoulders from catching ballerinas. And I wish I could dance with them. I wish I could feel the heft of them, to feel, rub our sweat together as we dance and move with them. And Melissa Hayden, oh, I love Melissa.
Well,
oh
and she
God,
loved you. She, on her deathbed in 2006, she tells you she loved you first. Her husband sitting right there.
Well, no, she says to her husband sitting there, Don, and she said, I always love you. You were the first.
Yeah.
And Don, who's half asleep, pops up and his eyeballs pop out and he looks around. What did he hear? And I immediately started saying, oh, yes, Don and I leading the parade of those that love you and trying to like this. And Melissa said, that's not what I said. But anyway, I asked my wife later, and my wife said, you knew her and danced with her 10 years before she ever met Don. And that's what she was saying.
Yeah, because it does sound as if in many of these cases, dancing with someone is love. Is a form of love.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
After Balanchine died in 1983, from a human version of mad cow disease, it's thought from animal organ injections he was taking to try to stay young. We hear more about Lincoln Kirstein. You write about this man who he's the fundraiser for. He's the one who runs the New York City Ballet. But he runs around telling you, as well as then-dancer Peter Martins and another dancer, Joseph Duell, that each of you were going to be the one to lead the company. An incredible
poor
time.
Poor guy.
Yeah, you say poor guy, but he sounds almost mad in parts.
And he was.
And yet you write, I loved Balanchine, but I loved Lincoln more.
Yes.
How? He seemed so crazy and sometimes cruel.
Because he was vulnerable. Balanchine was invulnerable. And when he said, I believe this, I want it, there was no brooking. He had no doubts. Lincoln chewed his hands, his heart, his very flesh apart. As I said, he had pebbles in his brain case rattling. And they were all pebbles of, you're a failure, Lincoln, you don't know what you're talking about. Meanwhile, his ambition and his giant strength and his genius, he was such a brilliant man, wanted to be czar of all the arts in America. And those things were driving him all his life. And somehow or other, I knew what he was. I understood it. And I just wanted to hug him and pat him on the shoulder and say, Lincoln, it's all right. Lincoln, it's all right. And I guess you could transform that as a form of love. Balanchine, I never wanted to pat him on the shoulder and say, it's all right, George, it's all right. Because he knew it was all right. He had no doubts.
Well, as the New York City Ballet goes through that transitional time after he dies, you start the National Dance Institute, this tremendous organization that brings dance to kids across the U.S. and now around the world. Here's a little clip from the Academy Award-winning documentary that was made about you and the National Dance Institute. It's called He Makes Me Feel Like Dancing.
Countdown, 5, 6, 7, go, and 1, 2, 3, 4.
If children are involved in the arts by functioning in them at an early age, the arts will always be part of their life.
The Dance Institute, Jacques d'Amboise, became this incredible second life for you. In fact, tell us the story. You're on a subway, and there's a guy on the subway there, and people start edging away from him. They think he looks like a thug, and he comes up to you.
And he's got this beard, and he's got these intense eyes and this long hair, kind of. And he's staring at me, and I'm beginning to think, uh-oh. When he says, I was a tomato. And I knew, oh, you were in the show that we did, El Milieu Ami, about the bistro, and you were Tomat Sala Provençal. That was PS 40, I think. And I said, what are you doing now? Meanwhile, everybody who's been edging away, right, for when he said I was a tomato, of course, the very dust in the air stopped. I said, what happened to you? He said, I became a musician. I'm doing it, and I'm playing down. And suddenly the door came, and he zoomed out, and other people came in, and the door shut. And the people around me that were still there said, do you have a school? Can I send my children?
Well, you sure have a school. It's been terrific for all these kids who go. But, you know, dance historian Jennifer Homans, in her bestseller Apollo's Angels, writes about how she thinks ballet is dying. What do you think?
It's an argument that has caused a lot of disagreement. And from me as well, in the sense that my idea of classical ballet is an art form that attempts to be out of the ordinary, gravity-less. And it's the aspiration of everyone that we will better ourselves. And I think that is never, never going to go.
Jacques d'Amboise, an American dance legend, for more than 30 years, principal dancer at George Balanchine's New York City Ballet, also founder of the National Dance Institute, bringing dance to kids. His new memoir is I Was a Dancer. And was he ever? Jacques d'Amboise, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you. Thank you, dear.